Hare Krishna, this is Anadhar Swami. We can all thank Gail for calling me. Let's see where I'm at right now. Wow. I went into a time warp and I lost the day. I'm really sorry. I just thought today was Tuesday for some reason. I think that's what happens when you travel. I just finished about 10 days of kind of a whirlwind tour, and I just drove up here and I wound up here. And I was thinking it was Tuesday. So I'm also not prepared, but maybe I can just start speaking from some kind of realization or something that I saw, and hopefully that's... Actually, when I was coming here, I saw one of the ladies. I'm upstate now, and she has, this is her third child. And, you know, it's a nuclear family. It's a tremendous amount of work to take care of a child. And I just see that, you know, her life is compromised in so many ways. I mean, all the things that she wants to do, she can't do. You know, a person is very creative and have a lot of energy. And she's just with the child all the time. And but I noticed how surrendered she is to the service. I'm not mentioning the lady because sometimes you mention names, it's embarrassing. I noticed how surrendered she is to the service and how peaceful she is. And, you know, I made a comment to her that it seems much different from the first children, you know, because it seems what happens is when the first child is born, it's such a shock to the person's life. You know, people have so much freedom before they have children, you know, to do what they want more and control their environment and move here and do this and take care. And then all of a sudden, a child becomes the center of one's world. And instead of moving the world according to one's desire, one themselves is moved according to their child's desire. And I was complimenting the person on the kind of level of maturity and expressing that, you know, it's really what Krishna consciousness is about. It's surrendering to Krishna's will, you know, not fighting to control and change the world around us for our own desire. Of course, we try to change the world for our, you know, purification, our benefit, our happy, whatever it is. But I'm noticing this, and when I said that to her, you know, it seemed initially, you know, when a woman has a child, it's such a shock that they have to so much surrender, you know, to surrender that their world is completely dictated by the desire of someone else, and that there's some kind of frantic anxiety and reaction of being unhappy with that and anxiety and trying to somehow fight free or not be happy with the situation. And the lady said exactly, but she said it's actually a kind of happiness to it. And I really think that I see also a lot of people coming to spiritual life, you know, and the first thing that people want to, the first reaction to spiritual life is that I'm unhappy with my life, I'm unhappy with my duties, you know, and I want to renounce them, you know, which is fine that we want a better situation, a better life. But while we have duties imposed upon us, you know, we have to accept that as Krishna's will and get the joy in responding to Krishna's will. And I'm seeing more and more that that really has to be what a very strong component of what Krishna consciousness is. You know, and basically, Krishna consciousness means living in Krishna's world, living in a world that's dictated by the desire of God, and living in a world dictated by the desire of Guru, which does not mean to give up our own needs and desires, because that's not the desire, the will of God, but it means to conform our life ultimately to the desire of Guru and Krishna. And some things that are unpleasant may be the desire of Krishna for us to surrender a situation to take care of it. I also saw in the same thing, I was thinking of a young, you know, passionate, brilliant man who came to Krishna consciousness. You know, very, very highly Ivy League, you know, successful after Ivy League sportsman. And I saw, you know, initially, you know, it's such a desire to learn Sanskrit, to learn this, to learn that, you know, to change one's life, to live in an ashram, to, you know. And then I saw the person, you know, and, you know, he was kind of winding up his business and he was doing his business again. And he, you know, he studied a little of the Shastra and came to the understanding, you know, that right now that this was his duty. He had to earn some money. And that acceptance of Krishna's will and surrendering to Krishna's will is a fundamental part of Krishna consciousness, because it's giving up the false ego, which dictates something else. You know, it's giving up the false ego, which is dictating something else besides Krishna's will. And that's how one becomes transcendental, giving up the false ego, because the false ego is what binds the soul to the body, and it's the conception of the enjoyer and the controller. And giving up that sense of enjoyment and control and replacing it with the will of Krishna is the helping us transcend that false ego, or creating the real ego and detaching us from the body and the mind and actually making us peaceful. This is what happens at death. Death means when death comes and a person has a terminal disease, that God is announcing, you're not the controller. And I'm moving the world completely against your desire on the basis of false ego. But this is my desire. There's a higher purpose. And when one fights that too strongly against one's duty and against the situation that comes, binds one into the false egoistic conception, it binds one into the body, and causes more suffering. And when one surrenders to Krishna's will, whether it's at death, why wait till death, whether it's in one's life, and surrendering to Krishna's will doesn't mean just to do our duty. It means to surrender to our duty and to accept our duties. And so I'm seeing this, you know. It's interesting, though, at the same time that this person I was talking about surrendered to his duties, he was also making a plan to have another duty that was more suited to what's nature. So when you surrender to destiny, you're surrendering to the destiny that comes upon you, not to what's happening in the future, which you can change. But he was making a better plan for him at the same time. So, you know, not having prepared the Narada Bhakti Sutras somehow, that's really what I've been thinking about, and thinking about in terms of my own life. Which God has given me, I don't know why, he's given me a lot of freedom. So all the situations in my life have to be more self-imposed than others. Because I don't have family responsibilities, I don't have institutional responsibilities. You know, right now, basically, you know, I don't have even writing projects that are really pressing. So that's another challenge. Besides that, you know, I'm realizing also it's a little personal how much traveling makes a man old. I was thinking of going someplace again this weekend, but I'm going to spend upstate here just to regulate my life more. But it was just wonderful. I went out for 10, 12 days, and it's an amazing phenomenon now of how many people are coming to... good people are becoming interested in bhakti and Krishna consciousness. It's really blowing my mind. When I was in the bhakti center for that 6-hour kirtan, it was wonderful. How many people, I must have been 100 people that have come that weren't really ISKCON or committed, but, you know, interested in bhakti, besides all the devotees that were there. And just coming and it's really wonderful and just meeting people all day long. That's really kind of wonderful. Having said that, I'm really sorry again that I'm late, and it confirms in my mind why, you know, I have to be a little bit more temperate in traveling. You just lose sight of things. It's funny, my mind just calculated that this was Tuesday, it's Wednesday. Just somehow in my mind, I said, oh, it's Tuesday. Let's see if there's anything else I can speak extemporaneously on that. Okay, are there any questions?
Where do I begin, Maharaj?
Well, go ahead, ask. We can exchange. It'll be nice. Otherwise, I speak on another subject.
Okay. It's not actually on what you just spoke on, though. But it's,
whatever.
I think
this is kind of free day.
You know, you say that, and I mean, it is said that the most powerful way to awaken one's bhakti is by absorbing one's mind in Krishna, by chanting his name, hearing Krishna katha, and acting for Krishna's pleasure. Anyway, basically, by hook or by crook, absorb your mind in Krishna in a favorable way.
Okay.
And so when I hear that, it almost sounds as though, you know, we're trying to do that. We're trying to awaken our bhakti on the strength of doing that, on the strength of those efforts. But it's actually that Krishna is not the strength of those efforts. It's that when we do things like chanting and hearing and you know, devoting our activities, what's actually happening is that Krishna reciprocates with that effort by bestowing his mercy. I guess by bestowing his mercy, but is that right?
I'm just amazed, Gail, by the subtlety of your brain. It's a very good question. It's not, yeah, I have presented it that way. Gail's question is, and I'm going to replay, you know, I've been stressing in the last thing that how bhakti works is that you focus your mind on Krishna, and then, you know, sangha means you open your heart to, something you value, and then the qualities of that object affect you. And that's how bhakti works. You open your heart to Krishna, and then the qualities of Krishna, they shock you, the bhakti affects you. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur did say that every object has a vastu, a shakti. Objects of bhakti have a bhakti shakti. So they affect or influence us in that way when we kind of have sangha with them. But Gail says, isn't that just like basically just effort, you know? And isn't it the reciprocation of Krishna that actually makes us advance? Just like in Desham Satatiya Dhanam Bhajatam Priti Purvakam Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tvam Yenama. One who worship me, faith and devotion, I give them the intelligence by which they come back to me. So, so the answer is that you that focus with faith and that focus on Krishna really can't be done without faith and devotion. It is our dependence, and it is our dependence, and it is our. It is our dependence, and it is our devotion that inspires us to focus our mind on Krishna. So Krishna is not just responding to a physical act; he's responding to our devotion, and. When you enter into that relationship with Krishna, there is an effect from that. It's an attraction. We're attracted to Krishna. So when you're focusing your consciousness on Krishna, when you focus your consciousness on Krishna, we become attracted to Krishna, which is bringing out the nature of our soul, which is devotion and love. So that's there in a fact. At the same time, Krishna is reciprocating with us and giving us inspiration and removing the obstacles and giving us grace. So that element is also there, but both elements are there. When you focus on an object of devotion, then you become attracted to it. Naturally. And that combination of devotionally focusing on Krishna and drawing out our love for Krishna, which is increasing our dependence on Krishna, also invokes within him a certain reciprocation. I think both those aspects are there in Bhakti. And it's not just a mechanical process. It's not just a mechanical process. But turning our consciousness to Krishna is based on love for Krishna. Otherwise, one doesn't do it. And there's Vaidhi Bhakti and there's Raghunuga Bhakti. Vaidhi Bhakti means what? We're doing that out of an understanding. We're doing that of an understanding that it's the right thing to do. And then as it really, really becomes bhakti, our focus is not just out of an understanding, it's done out of love. But whether you focus it out of an understanding or you focus it out of love, there's love in both and there's absorption in both. Also says the spiritual master finds the ways and means to, he finds the ways and means to focus the disciple's consciousness on Krishna. So he's trying to create a situation where you can think of Krishna. Because when you think of Krishna, you become influenced by Krishna and you become attracted to Krishna. Therefore, the first verse in the Bhakti section of the Bhagavad Gita 7.1 says, Mayasakamano partha yogam yunchan maratvaya asamsayam samagama yata gasyasita churu. Just hear from me, mind attached to me. No, just hear from me in full consciousness of me, mind attached to me. You will come with me without doubt. So by hearing, our consciousness becomes focused on Krishna. And by that, attachment comes. In answer to your question, I think bhakti goes from two levels. One, focusing on Krishna brings out our natural attraction for Krishna. And as that natural attraction for Krishna comes out, which enhances that focus on Krishna, which is an expression of giving our consciousness in love to Krishna, Krishna also reciprocates. Gail, does that answer your question?
I think so. It sounds like you're saying it's part mechanical and part reciprocation.
I don't think it, but well, it can be mechanical, but that's not the only reason you focus on Krishna. And I'm just saying, even if it's mechanical, you're doing it out of a discipline. There's some love. There's some faith. There's some, you know, faith in Krishna. And faith is the seed of prema. There's some appreciation. Otherwise, why will you do it? So there has to be some love to do that. Well, even, you know, but it's a fact, right? Even the demons who think of Krishna get liberation, right? They don't even have any love. So in that sense, yes, there's a kind of a mechanical aspect, but the focus doesn't have to be on the basis of like, you know, without love. Love generally focuses the consciousness, but there are cases, again, the Sukriti, where it's without love. But that seems to be one of the dynamics in which bhakti works, and another way in which bhakti works is that the reciprocation comes. Krishna gives us grace.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help, Gail?
Yeah. I mean, when I used the word mechanical, I didn't necessarily mean that it was without, you know, some kind of soft
sentiment. Okay, mechanical then.
Yeah.
Okay, mechanical yeah. then.
Oh, okay. Yes, okay, thank you.
Thank you for that question. A very wonderful question. Any other questions? Okay, you're all on here.
Do I get a second one? Is nobody asked?
Yeah, Gail, who knows if anybody even waited? I'm not going to even ask who's there today. It's too depressing because I kind of messed up. You know, it may just be me and you, but I'll see.
No, Amiya was there too.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What else, Gil?
Yeah, I just, you know, back to an earlier discussion we had about the fact that, you know, when Krishna is sufficiently satisfied with the level of love that we have developed for him through the process of sadhana bhakti,
yeah,
then he injects into our heart his own, you know, shakti, and we experience bhava bhakti. And so,
yeah,
and so, you know, I get the understanding that the love that we develop through sadhana, that's somehow different from the love that he injects into us, right? Is it different thing?
It's, you know, this isn't the kind of difficult question, because I think people look at it in different ways. One way you can look at it is that completely, you know, the bhakti is in our heart, and what comes is like a watering process that brings it out fully.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then it says when that bhava comes, which is the Samvit Ladini Shakti, and it comes and it energizes the mind, then it becomes one with the mind. In a sense, it's called the deal, like a hot iron rod and fire. The iron rod becomes fire. So that's also there, that the iron rod becomes fire. And so it becomes, you know, it's hard to distinguish. But there is some sense too, and I'd like to understand that all Shakti is ultimately connected with Radha. She's the Purna Shakti, to please Krishna. It's that says in the CC that Radharani is the Purna Shakti. She is the manifestation of Shakti. The energy is meant to love and please Krishna. It has an intention to please Krishna. The energy is alive. That's love. So I believe our soul, Jiva Shakti, has that energy of loving and pleasing Krishna, but it's infinitesimal. But when that energy of loving Krishna is fully manifest to our capacity, there's something else that comes to energize us, and that's Krishna's own bliss potency, the essence of the internal potency. So I do believe there's also an energy of God that's placed in our heart to offer back and please him. So I think there is, in one sense, that dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. My only problem with the iron rod and fire analogy was that, you know, the mind is supposed to be, you know, matter. I mean, we can purify it so that, you know, it behaves, you know, like a soul or something. But
yeah,
to say that, you know, his energy and our mind become like one is like saying that.
Well, it could be our. It could. Well, it depends whether there. Well, it could be our soul is energized then. You know, whether there's a Gyanavritti in the soul, a aspect of the soul. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur indicates that there are some faculties in the soul that become energized. So we can say that it actually energizes the soul. And in one sense, perhaps the mind is like a lens, and it becomes colored in that way to help us see with love and devotion. But let's say the energy touches our soul. And somehow our intrinsic nature is to be a receptacle for that energy. But there's also energy coming from us. There's also desire to serve to come from us. The desire to serve reaches its perfection when the full energy of Krishna descends on our consciousness and is offered back then. that's how I reconcile the two different understandings of bhakti. Of one, as Prabhupada said, like a child walking, the capacity to walk manifests. So the capacity to serve is no doubt there. The capacity to love is no doubt there. But that the full capacity manifests when the energy of Krishna, the full loving energy of Krishna manifests in our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Okay? Yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, we still have time. I mean, when I'm not engaging in text,
Hi,
well, you know, I have my.
This is Allegra. I've been listening on your conversation also.
Who is this?
Allegra.
Oh, Allegra. Thank you for waiting on, and I'm really sorry that I kind of came on late. Allegra, please ask a question. Yes.
Well, at the beginning, it sounded like you were speaking about the Seva Bhav that you had mentioned earlier.
Speaking about what?
The Seva Bhav that you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
That, you know, Krishna consciousness is really, as you said, surrender to the will of God, where you're not fighting.
Right.
You're not fighting that. And I found that a really interesting definition of that mood of Seva, which I've been thinking about a lot. I would maybe ask you to expand on that a little more, but I don't know if there'd be anything beyond what you already spoke about that. I don't know.
Well, I can speak about it a little bit more, but the false ego is what? I am the controller and I am the enjoyer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the false ego is. And when I'm the enjoyer and I'm controller, one is focused on one's own desires, material desires, to situate oneself in a centered way to enjoy and control. And the mood of service, which is the antithesis of false conception of life, the false ego, the material conception, is when the desire of Krishna becomes prominent. And the example is given, I sometimes use this example of the body. The body is, if you consider the body is the ultimate reality. As an analogy, let's say, I'm using it as an analogy. Just as God is consciousness, which is inclusive of everything, let's say my body represented God, right? So the false conception of life would be that the hand is separate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the desire of the hand would become prominent, right? And so that would be the false conception of the hand. The false conception of the hand is that it's independent of the body. That's a false conception. And that conception would be, let's say if the hand was not only a part of the body, but a sentient part that had its own volition. And if the hand, the false conception of the hand is to enjoy things separately. Right? Now, the real conception of the hand, that it's part of the body, and therefore it serves the body. So that, and therefore what becomes prominent is the needs of the body. The hand serves the needs of the body. I am hungry. The body is hungry. It's for the whole body. Then the hand gets food. Right? And then part of the body is injured, and the hands are serving the that part of the body, you know, that's broke, but it's for the whole body. So that's Seva Bhav. Seva Bhav is when you're focused on the universal desire. You're focused which also includes our needs, because that's part of the universal desire. Just like the hand is part of the body, it's serving the body, but the hand has its own needs for the service of the body. So we have our own, even within our particular material nature, our particular situation, we have our own needs. But our needs are to function in relationship to God, which is the totality of everything. So I think Seva Bhava, that mood of Seva, seeing it through Seva, is seeing it through the desires of God. Seeing it through some principles, some universal desires, rather than the consciousness that I am the center. And I think the false ego, or the subtle elements that bind us to the body, are caused by that independent desire. And that's how it's fulfilled, through the field of activities of the body and the illusion that that's a separate enjoyer, not connected to anything beyond itself. So I really think this is a really important conception, to actually see the world through the eyes of the soul. And when I'm doing these guiding people in kirtan meditations, etc., I try to have them chant in a way that they're contacting the soul and the soul's desire to serve, the soul's desire to please, the soul's desire to be grateful. And you can actually make a dichotomy between that kind of feeling when you're chanting of the soul and the desires of the soul and the feelings of the soul to give oneself and to serve, and the fluctuations of the mind and the anxieties of the mind, which are generally based on the false ego. And when people enter into that space, sometimes I ask them to, really try to enter and really feel that space, and then to open their eyes gradually, trying to see the world through that consciousness. So, yeah, okay. Allegra, does that help?
Yeah, that's a very helpful framework.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for asking the question, and thank you for being on. It's kind of, Gail called me up on my other phone, and I'm just so happy to, so that I didn't miss the full Sangha, and that people stayed on, that I may speak and share some things. I'm really encouraged now, and I think everyone, including myself, needs this now, some real quality time to really concentrate on non-bhajan and becoming just totally dependent on God. And, okay,
hi.
Anything else from anybody? Yeah. Hi, Krishna.
This is Sneha. I just had a question. Sneha?
Sneha, oh, wonderful. Thank you.
I wanted to know, how do you know, you were talking about how, when you surrender to Krishna's free will, you're actually being Krishna conscious. Now, in day-to-day life, how do you know that something is Krishna's will?
How do you know that something is Krishna's will? Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's a good question. First, let's find the things that are Krishna's will, right, that we know are Krishna's will and we're not doing. So that's the first thing. There are a lot of things that are Krishna's will and we're not doing. Then Krishna's will is expressed through Shastra, and Guru and Sadhus who help us to come in touch with Krishna's will. And sometimes, like in the Bhagavad Gita, there's basically Krishna's will means dharma, our duties, what we should be doing. So I guess your question actually comes down to, you know, sometimes it's a little subtle, you know, because we have various dharmas. Just like Arjuna, what was Krishna's will? Was it Krishna's will to fight in the war, or was Krishna's will not to? And it was really subtle because his relatives were on the other side. So the Bhagavad Gita, what it does, it reveals what Krishna's will is on all different levels. We have certain duties, prescribed duties according to our nature, that's Krishna's will. We have certain duties that are just religious duties, that is Krishna's will. And then there's his direct devotional service, which is will. And if there's any confusion, in other words, it's all Shastra and the application of Shastra to our life, which reveals what Krishna's will is. And basically, what's Krishna's will? How do we respond to the situations in our life and make those decisions? So if there's any confusion of what it is, in a detached way, we have to approach and consult, you know, the Vaishnavas. Because a lot of times, it's hard for us with our own attachments to distinguish between what is Krishna's will and what is our own attachments. Even I know one of my godbrothers said, you know, he thought that those that are sannyasis in our movement of gurus or something, it would be real healthy that they had a committee of people where they put forth before them what their programs and activities are to let them make judgment and approve, people who they trusted, because it's such a tendency to see through our attachments. So how do you know Krishna's will? Krishna's in our heart as the super soul. If we control our senses and we're very, very sincere and we open ourselves up to Krishna, what you want, I will do. Krishna has a way of revealing it. But first we have to become detached. Otherwise our attachments will obscure Krishna's will. A lot of times where I couldn't decide what to do, in Vrindavan, I used to go into Prabhupada Samadhi and just first clear myself of any personal agenda and just throw my hands up and say, Prabhupada, what you want, reveal it to me, I will do. And a lot of times when we're in that consciousness, the answer becomes clear because it's not obscured by our attachments. But if still there's some confusion, then we can submit it to higher authority. A lot of times the difficulty in making decisions or understanding what Krishna's will is, a lot of times it's because on the mental plane. What the mental plane is the subtle calculation for sense pleasure and egotistical satisfaction based on the false ego. And when that happens, there's a lot of mental agony trying to find out which situation pleases our senses and mind. But when it's a question of service, then all of a sudden, a lot of the options, we can choose either one, and it's not such a crisis. But if there's real difficulty in understanding, when it all comes down to it, I really can't clearly see Krishna's will, we can surrender and consult the Vaishnavas and even ask them, what should I do? And Krishna will speak through them. Does that help you, Sneha?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
You're mentioned.
Maybe I should do this. Maybe this was Krishna's arrangement that I was late. There's so many nice, everyone's asking so many nice questions. So maybe at least once a month I should just have questions and answers like this. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Brajaraveg.
Hare Krishna, thank you. You also waited, that's so nice.
Hare.
I'll have to come again to your house to another nice program.
Okay. Sure, Maharaj.
Okay, anybody else like to say hello or ask any question? Okay, we'll end now with my deepest gratitude to all the listeners for engaging me in Hari Katha. Thank you so much. And thank you, Gail, for getting me on here by calling me.
Thank you, Maharaj. It was actually a selfish act.